the 2018 Winter Olympics are underway. And like many of you, I watched the opening ceremonies, which was quite a thrilling display of lights and pageantry and dancing and music, and a myriad of special effects that brought a sense of transcendence to the world, if even for a short time. Despite the conflicts and violence in our worlds, the Olympics bring people of the world together in a spirit of unity and solidarity for a few short weeks. The opening ceremonies represent a spectacular display that grabs our attention and gives the world a unified focus, if only for a short time. As amazing as human displays such as these are, they pale in comparison to the glory, the divine manifestation as the one we'll be considering today. Today is Transfiguration of the Lord Sunday on the liturgical calendar. It's the final Sunday in the season of Epiphany before the season of Lent starts on Ash Wednesday. And it's kind of an interesting holiday. We don't quite know what to make of Transfiguration of the Lord Sunday. We read the account in Scripture, and it seems like a very strange episode where Jesus transfigures before his inner circle of disciples, then cryptically tells them not to say anything about it till after his resurrection. So what is this strange incident of the transfiguration of the Lord? Why does it appear in the Gospels? And most importantly, what does it mean for us today? We'll explore these questions today as we look at this account from Mark's Gospel. This occurs in the middle of Mark's Gospel. We've been spending time looking at the beginning of Mark's Gospel, the beginning of Jesus' earthly ministry. But now the lectionary jumps ahead to the middle of the book. And this passage comes just after Peter's profession of faith in chapter 8, which we'll look at in a few weeks in more detail. But today we see Jesus taking his inner circle of disciples, which was Peter, James, and John, and they go up on a high mountaintop by themselves. And then Jesus transfigures before them, becoming dazzling white light. It said whiter than any human could bleach them. And Moses and Elijah appear with him, talking to him. And Peter, who often acts as the spokesperson for the group, whether they want him to or not, offers to make three dwellings, one for each of them, one for Jesus, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And Mark indicates that Peter says this out of fear, verse 6, not really understanding the implications of what he's saying, which is not unusual for Peter, if you read the Gospels. Just then God speaks out of the heavens, saying, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." And these are the same words, you recall, that God spoke at Jesus' baptism in chapter 1. Then all of a sudden, they look around and there's no one there but Jesus, and the white light is gone and everything's back to normal, just like that. It's a weird story, especially to us modern readers, because we don't have these kind of encounters happening. I don't think any of us can say that we've seen this anything close to what this transfiguration, as it's described, we've never experienced anything like that. So what is this story all about, and why does Mark include it? Well, we may not realize it, but there's a lot of Old Testament imagery going on here, and it would take too long to unpack all of these fully. Perhaps this would make good material for a Sunday school class where we could go more in depth, but I do want to touch on a few points here. The whole episode looked a lot like a theophany, which was a miraculous manifestation of God's presence, like the glory cloud that led God's people through the wilderness in the Old Testament. The mountaintop would have been reminiscent of Moses speaking with God when receiving the Ten Commandments. And Moses and Elijah were prominent figures in the Hebrew Scriptures. Many scholars think they represent the law and the prophets and are precursors to the coming Messiah. But there's another more important observation here that a scholar explains. Both Moses and Elijah were two figures whose passings were mysterious. They were believed by many Jews to be God's precursors of the end times, because Elijah went bodily into heaven, as said in 2 Kings chapter 2, and Moses' grave was never found. He was buried by God himself in Deuteronomy 34. And And these two men of faith were thought to be available for God to bring back. God would send them to inform humankind that God's reign was at hand. So it's no accident that these two appear with Jesus on the mountaintop. They discuss the change already prophesied by Jesus, Mark 1:15. And as these two messengers disappear into the cloud, a sign of God's presence, the word comes to listen to Jesus, the only one left. Now Jesus becomes the divinely chosen precursor of the turn of the age. Another point a scholar makes is, according to some Jewish expectation, as stated in the book of Zechariah, God would usher in the new age, the day of the Lord, as it's described, during the Feast of Booths. The God-commanded festival kept by Jews for centuries was considered a possible time for God's taking control of God's creation and beginning the age of Shalom. The word booths here, dwellings, is often referred to as booths. They would have understood this. So Peter's question about building booths is not laughable or mistaken. He's following the tradition that they believed at that time. Peter is clear that the end times are coming and the Feast of Booths was upon them. Moses, Elijah, and Jesus need not construct their own booths for the celebrations. The disciples were there. They would do that. So they're putting all this together that we might not be aware is happening. The dwellings, tabernacles or booths, were temporary dwelling places of God's people and believed to be a dwelling place for God, who has promised a tabernacle amongst his people. Peter recognized this and wanted to construct these booths, these dwellings, in anticipation and recognition of the coming of the Messiah. Jesus was the Messiah at the end of the age. Now, what Peter had wrong about the way these events were going to be brought about was, he had an expectation that the Messiah was going to be a powerful political figure, overthrow the Romans, and reestablish the Davidic monarchy. He didn't understand that the Messiah was going to come as a suffering figure who would be subjected to the cross and even death itself, and then who would rise from the dead, a point which the other disciples clearly did not understand. Just prior, in Mark chapter 8, Peter makes this profession of faith and then rebukes Jesus when Jesus starts talking about the suffering and death on the cross. And then Jesus in turn rebukes Peter, saying he's not getting it. And then tells them to take up their cross and follow him. Then we have this strange encounter. So all this is leading up to this transfiguration account. Up until this point in Mark's gospel, it had looked like God's kingdom was advancing. It was all healings and miracles and crowds and success. But at this point, Mark's gospel takes a turn. These two chapters, chapters 8 and 9, are kind of the turning point of the book. And from this point on, Jesus moves quickly toward Jerusalem, into the suffering, into the cross. And so with all this background in mind, what does this account mean? Well, a scholar notes, as Jesus is transfigured, Peter, James, and John, and Mark's audience catch a glimpse of his reality as the Son of Man, God's chosen messenger of God's reign. Putting all this together, we have a story that reassures Jesus' core disciples and Mark's readers. Jesus' prediction of betrayal and death and resurrection are to be trusted. The struggles yet to come for Jesus should in no way diminish the confidence in his promises or his predictions of resurrection. As Mark's gospel drives toward the bitterness of the passion, the story itself shines as a beacon of hope. God has not left God's people without guidance, without help, without hope ever. From Moses to Elijah to Daniel to Jesus, perhaps to Mark, the writer of this good news, and including many more persons of faith, we continually are helped to see the way of God in the world, as well as the promise of God, God's future for all of us. In this account, I believe that Jesus is giving the disciples a picture of the glory that awaits them on the other side of the cross. God's promises are sure. Jesus will face suffering and death, but this will not be the final word. Jesus will rise. God's redemptive plans will not be thwarted. The disciples' work is not in vain. So what does all of this mean for us as 21st century Christians seeking to follow Christ in our time? Well, like Peter and the other disciples, I think that we find encounters with Jesus like this transfiguration, disconcerting. We don't know what to make of them. We don't know how to respond. One commentator describes an experience he had while taking a class at seminary in New York City with a professor, Esther DeWall. He writes, in our first class, she said that when people enter places that completely overwhelm them, such as a grand cathedral or a monumental museum, they tend to gravitate toward the plaques and placards which dot the walls. If you've been to places, you'll see there'll be a big painting and then a little plaque explaining who created it and a little bit about it. The placards describe the stained glass window or that work of art. And the professor says that people gravitate toward those anchors so they don't emotionally and spiritually sink into the mire. They can't handle the sheer weight of a soaring vault or a work after work of Matisse, so they find little squares with plain writing on them as a defense mechanism to get them through the experience. It's safer, it's easier to process. The problem is, this person notes, of course, is that if you spend most of your time with the little square plaques, you miss out on the experience to truly experience something that if you let it in, might end up changing you in some way. So while you might be overwhelmed with the transcendence of the art or the architecture around you, if you go to the safe spots, the little safe placards, you're missing the opportunity to experience the bigger picture, even if you can't fully take it all in. I think it's a little bit what's happening here. Peter's attempt to build these little dwellings were like the museum goers, focusing on the little markers, the little placards for comfort and orientation, rather than risk being overwhelmed by the transcendence of this massive spiritual experience. When we're uncomfortable, when we're disoriented by an experience that is beyond our explanation or control, I think we're tempted to bottle it up, nail it down, and bolt it to the floor to keep it from overwhelming us. If we're honest, human beings often react in fear to things we can't understand or control. And so we try to create these defense mechanisms to make what's unmanageable more manageable. And we see evidence of this fear in our everyday world. We fear life events. We fear illness. We fear getting old. We fear losing our independence. We fear the stock market going down. We fear not having enough for retirement. We fear not getting a job. We fear what will happen to our kids, to our parents, to our friends, to our loved ones. We fear the world we live in. Just watch the evening news. There's a lot to be afraid of. We fear the polarization and conflict in our culture. We fear the government. We fear other governments. We fear the threat of war. We fear other people. We fear change. We fear what we cannot control or understand. We fear living and we fear dying. And this fear extends to the church. We fear not having enough money, not having enough people, not having enough of what we're used to. The religious experiences of the good old days, the fear of the unknown. We fear that Jesus will ask too much of us if we turn too much over to him. We fear the powerful manifestations of Christ on the mountaintop transfiguring before us. We're more content with History Channel Jesus, who is sort of a historical figure from a long time ago, but doesn't expect too much of us now. Like Peter, we want to try to create dwellings, things to keep Jesus more under our control, safer. And we want to kind of stay there with this safe religious experience we've created. We don't want to go back down the mountain. For we know what happens at the foot of the mountain. We fear the suffering. We fear death. We fear our own mortality. So how do we combat this fear? Well, we're about to enter the season of Lent, which begins on Ash Wednesday, and it's a day when we reflect upon our own mortality. We literally reflect on our mortality. We let people spread ashes on our forehead that remind us you are dust and to dust you shall return. And we walk around all day with these ashes reminding us that we're going to die someday. It's kind of a sobering thought. But I think Lent is a real gift to us. It's like a spiritual safe space, well, as safe as any space can be on this subject. But it's a safe space that allows us to deal with fear, to deal with suffering, to deal with death in a constructive way. As Christians, we believe in resurrection, but we have to die first, and that's the hard part. And the story of the Transfiguration provides a ray of hope. A vision of glory at the start of a somber season. A reminder that there is light at the end of the tunnel. That though we must follow Jesus even to the cross and the tomb, glory and light and life await us on the other side. One commentator notes, Jesus takes his disciples with him up the mountain. After the period of revelation, transformation, and transfiguration, they come back down. Jesus could have stayed there. But he comes back down. Down, down into the mundane nature of everyday life. Down into the nitty-gritty details of misunderstanding, squabbling, disbelieving disciples. Down into the religious and political quarrels of the day. Down into the jealousies and rivalries, both petty and gigantic, that color our relationships. Down into the poverty and pain that are part and parcel of our life in this world. Down. Jesus came down. Jesus' downward movement from his rightful place in glory to embrace our lot and life out of love is in a very real sense the essence of the gospel. I have a hunch that deep down most of us think Jesus is a little too good for us. No matter how hard we try to be like Jesus, to be perfect, we know that we fall dreadfully short. As a consequence, we may feel that the most broken parts of our lives are the ones that keep us from being like Jesus and therefore are the farthest things from him. But this isn't a story about our going up. It's a story about Jesus coming down, all the way down into our brokenness, fear, disappointment, and loss. And of course, it only gets more so as we soon watch our Lord travel to the cross. They're embracing all that is hard, difficult, and even despicable in life in order to wrest victory from death itself, that we might live in hope, knowing that wherever we may go, Christ has already been, and that where Christ is now, we will one day be. In the darkest places of our lives, in the place of our greatest fear, Jesus is already there. Jesus is not afraid of what is difficult in our lives. That Jesus will not reject us on account of our failings. Jesus' descent back down the mountain reminds us that we don't have to hide the hard parts of our lives from God. For God the Father came to us in and through the incarnate Son, precisely to be with us and for us through thick and thin, through life and death. And indeed, God came in Jesus to be with us through death into new life. So trusting in the mercy of the one who came down the mountain, the one who entered the dark places of the world and still seeks out the dark places of our lives, trusting this one, perhaps we will be honest enough to name what is broken and hurting in our lives and in our world, and thereby fear it a little less. For no other reason, Jesus was born, lived, died, and was raised again, except that we might know that God is unrelentingly for us. Brothers and sisters, may this truth bring light to our days, this day and always. And may the Lord bless this message to our hearing.